Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's November 1st, and we're going to finish up endocrinology today. But according to the schedule, we should be moving on to muscle physiology today. So we're a little bit behind, so you got to make sure you keep coming to class to find out what you're responsible for on the next test, which is November 15th. That's going to be a Thursday. So that's going to be what? That's 2 weeks exactly from today. All right, so you just got to come to class. I don't know what's going to be on the test or if we might delay the test. I don't think we're going to delay the test. So anyway, you got to just come to class. All right, so we're talking about just beginning mechanisms of hormone action. And the mechanism of hormone action is going to be determined by its physical chemistry properties, whether it's hydrophilic or hydrophobic, for instance. Okay, so let's take a look at some of these things. In any case, yes. Oh, yeah, I sure can. Thanks. Let's do one and one. Good. Yeah, thanks for reminding me. Okay, in any case, you should think of a receptor hormone interaction the same way as an enzyme substrate interaction, and that the shape of the active site has to match up to the shape of the substrate, just like the shape of a receptor has to match up to the shape of the ligand that's going to bind to that receptor. All right, so target cell receptors show the same properties that we saw in enzymes. They have high specificity. That means the shapes of these of the receptor site and the receptor must be complementary to each other. And because of that, there's high affinity between those two shapes. They attract each other. And there's also one last thing here, and that is low capacity for hormone. That means that there are very few receptors in the body. So you don't need a whole lot of hormone to change the activity everywhere in your body. Lipophilic hormones have receptors on the target's cytoplasm. So inside the cell, not on the cell membrane, because lipophilic hormones can diffuse through the cell membrane, because the cell membrane is basically just that phospholipid bilayer. And once it gets into the cytoplasm, it can further diffuse into the nucleus through, and all these chemicals can go through the plasma membrane. All right, but the effect is going to be inside the nucleus, whether it's a cytoplasmic receptor or a nuclear receptor, and it's going to initiate transcription or have some kind of effect on transcription. And what the heck is transcription once again? I don't want to use that term if you all forgot what that means, but what is transcription? It's a step in protein synthesis, but what step of protein synthesis is it? It's the first step, right? So it's the conversion of information from DNA into messenger RNA. All right, so that is transcription. And since we're working on genes, we call this the genomic action of these lipophilic hormones. But because it involves protein synthesis, it takes a little while for that to happen, at least 30 minutes, and in some cases, much, much, much longer. So it's unlike an action potential or unlike just opening an ion channel that happens almost immediately when a ligand binds to a receptor. On the other hand, receptors that are water-soluble or hydrophilic receptors are found on the surface, the cell membrane of the target cell. And those hormones cannot enter the cell because they can't get through the cell membrane, so they usually act through second messenger systems. So the first messenger is the hormone that's trapped outside the cell, and the second messenger develops inside the cell. And on the tip of your tongue, you should probably have some ideas of what some of these second messengers can be. Does anybody have an idea of what a good second messenger is? G proteins can activate a second messenger. Okay, so yeah, I think you're going a step in the right direction. Usually we would think of maybe calcium or cyclic AMP inside of a cell, and those could be initiated through the activation of a G protein. Okay, some steroids also act on cell surface receptors, but they don't act as transcription factors then, and so we call that the non-genomic action of those steroid hormones. Okay, but there are not very many examples of that. So let's look and see how a lipophilic hormone typically operates inside of a cell. So lipid hormones travel in the blood attached to carrier proteins because lipids don't like to dissolve necessarily in blood because plasma is an aqueous solution. It's a water solution. So here has to be a carrier protein. So the lipid hormone binds to the carrier protein, which makes it soluble in water. And there's always going to be some free amount floating in the cytoplasm, though it's going to be a very small amount, and it's going to be in equilibrium with the carrier protein. So if this hormone that's in the plasma disappears, then some is going to hop off of this carrier protein because of Le Chatelier's principle, right? Because there's just equilibrium. If we take some of this hormone away, then some that's bound to the carrier is going to replace it. Or if we add a lot of hormone to this solution, then more will be bound to carrier proteins. That's just the law of mass action. All right, so then we have this hormone in plasma. It can freely diffuse through this plasma membrane and get into the cytoplasm. And here we have a receptor that's in the cytoplasm. So this is a cytoplasmic receptor, and it's called a nuclear hormone receptor because it's going to have an effect inside the nucleus. So the hormone binds to the receptor, and then it translocates into the nucleus where it interacts with the DNA molecule. Let's just go to the next slide. So this hormone, a nuclear hormone receptor, when it binds this hormone, it becomes a transcription factor, which means that it allows the transcription of this segment of DNA, which could not be transcribed otherwise. All right, so these nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors when they bind to hormone that activates transcription. And these hormones constitute a superfamily composed of all steroid and thyroid hormones. And it also includes a couple other compounds like vitamin D and retinoic acid. So we'll see how these things interact with some hormones that are in your body. Right? And vitamin D is not really a hormone. This is just an essential nutrient that you have to have in your body. Same thing for retinoic acid. Okay, so the nuclear hormone receptors, they have a ligand binding site and a DNA binding site that are together, and the ligand binding site binds the hormone. And after it binds the hormone, it translocates, like we said, into the nucleus, and it binds to the DNA molecule. The place where it binds to a DNA molecule is called a hormone response element. So here is the hormone response element on DNA. And you see it's a little bit complicated. It's just not one site. It actually has some fine structure to it. There are actually two sites right here. Right, so each one is a half site, and each half site can bind a nuclear hormone receptor. So in order for this to be a competent transcription factor, both of these sites right here have to be occupied by the nuclear hormone receptor that is bound to its particular receptor. And then the hormone response element becomes activated, and transcription will ensue, and that will produce a messenger RNA molecule. And then what happens once this messenger RNA molecule is made? Yeah, it will be translated, and a new protein will be produced inside the cell, and that protein might have some contribute to the structure of that cell, or might contribute to the function of that cell. It might be an enzyme. It might open up a metabolic pathway or some activity that that cell would not normally go through. Okay. So that would be the target gene that is activated when both of these half sites become occupied by nuclear hormone receptors. And so we call this dimerization because it requires two nuclear hormone receptors to bind to the hormone response element. We call that dimerization. And if they're the same hormone, we call that homodimerization because they're the same nuclear hormone receptors that bind to the hormone response element. Okay, dimerization, probably even a better term would be homodimerization. All right, so I talked about those two slides, so let's go to the next one. Let's talk about thyroid hormone in particular. We did look at thyroid hormone a little bit. We said there are two active forms. There's a T4 and a T3, right? And T4 is what we call thyroxine. 99% of T4 in the blood is bound to a carrier protein, and that carrier protein is the thyroid binding globulin, or TBG. And only the free form of T4 can enter cells. So the bound version kind of just acts as a reservoir, kind of like a battery for thyroid hormone that's being carried in your blood. And then once T4 enters a cell, it gets converted into triiodothreonine, or T3. And it's the T3 that becomes the active hormone inside the cell. So T3 binds to the receptor protein located inside the nucleus, and then that becomes a nice transcription factor as long as something else takes place. All right, so T3 and receptor bind to the first half site. The other half site binds to retinoic acid. Right? These two partner together to form a heterodimer that activates the HRE, the hormone response element. So this could be a homodimerization process for activating transcription or a heterodimerization process. So this is an example of heterodimerization where retinoic acid has to be present in the cell, and that allows then the permissive effect for triiodothreonine to become a transcription factor. So without retinoic acid inside the cell, even though you have proper levels of triiodothreonine, it can't act as a transcription factor. Okay, so there's an interaction, an important interaction that takes place right here. All right, so what kind of hormones are we considering when we're thinking about this dimerization step, whether it's a heterodimerization or homodimerization that act as a transcription factor? What kind of hormones are those? What's some of the physical chemistry of those hormones? They are, since it's inside the cell or inside the nucleus, right, then they have to be hydrophobic or lipophilic kinds of hormones, like steroid hormones, for instance, or thyroid hormones. Those would be the two classes. All right, so, and then the opposite class would be the hydrophilic kinds of hormones. And those hydrophilic hormones cannot enter the cell. They have to bind to extracellular receptors or receptors that are on the plasma membrane. They can't get inside the cell. So these hormones become first messengers that initiate the production of second messengers inside the cell. All right, so let's look and see how that happens. And remember, these are for hydrophilic signaling compounds or hormones. So water-soluble hormones use cell surface receptors because they can't pass through the cell membrane. Their actions are mediated by second messengers that build up inside the cell. The hormone is the first messenger. It's the extracellular signal, right? And the second messenger carries the signal from the receptor to inside the cell. And so let's look at some second messengers. One that we've talked about before is cyclic AMP. And cyclic AMP is built from ATP. So ATP is a precursor, and there's an enzyme that converts it into cyclic AMP. So it chops off two phosphates from ATP to make it an AMP, but it's a special form of AMP. It has a ring structure to it. It's not a linear adenosine monophosphate molecule. It's a cyclic adenosine monophosphate. And since it's cyclic, it has a different structure compared to the linear form. And if it has a different structure, then you could tell me it performs different functions inside the cell because it has a different structure. All right, so cyclic AMP mediates effects of many polypeptide and glycoprotein hormones because these hormones can actually enter the cell. The hormone binds to a receptor on the extracellular side of the membrane, and this is a G protein coupled receptor. We've talked about these before. These are very common all over the body and in many organisms. So here is the receptor protein, and notice that it spans the whole membrane. So when it becomes activated on the outside surface of the membrane, it can influence things inside the membrane or on the intracellular side of the membrane. And in this particular case, we see a nice G protein. So if you see this alpha, beta, gamma right here, that's kind of a dead giveaway that it's a G protein. But that could also kind of lead you to think, well, maybe that's an ATP, because an ATP has an alpha phosphate, a beta phosphate, and a gamma phosphate. But that's not really what we're talking about. These are proteins. When the receptor becomes activated by binding the hormone, then the G protein dissociates and is released from the receptor, and these subunits can diffuse around inside the lipid world of the membrane, and it can bump into other proteins that are inserted into the plasma membrane, including adenylate cyclase. And you remember that adenylate cyclase is the enzyme that converts ATP into cyclic AMP specifically, and a couple of waste products right here, inorganic pyrophosphate, which means two phosphate groups that are added to, that are joined together by a chemical bond. Okay, so now we have so this is a nice level of amplification because it just requires one hormone binding to the receptor activating this enzyme, and then how many second messengers or how many cyclic AMPs build up inside the cytoplasm when adenylate cyclase becomes activated? A lot. I don't even want to give you a number, but thousands. Because remember, an enzyme does not get used up during the reaction. All right? So as long as the alpha unit is still bound to adenylate cyclase, then it's going to keep converting ATP into cyclic AMP, which is now the second messenger inside the cell. Cyclic AMP is going to diffuse around through the cytoplasm, and it will bump into other molecules that have receptor sites, right, complementary sites that match the shape of cyclic AMP. And some of these sites are located on inhibitory subunits which are bound to enzymes, like a protein kinase. What the heck is a protein kinase? It's an enzyme that does what? That phosphorylates something, okay? So when the protein kinase is bound to this inhibitory subunit, it is turned off, but when cyclic AMP is present, then protein kinase becomes activated. It's turned on. The switch is turned on. The inhibitory subunit is removed from the enzyme because it's bound to cyclic AMP. These are all just conformation changes that occur after binding. So now we have an active protein kinase that will phosphorylate a number of different kinds of enzymes, and it can activate some enzymes or it could inactivate some enzymes depending on what the cell has built up inside the cytoplasm. Okay, so the effect of this one hormone, okay, we see one level of amplification due to adenylate cyclase. We see another level of amplification due to this protein kinase. Remember, we call that a cascade mechanism. So this mechanism can happen relatively quickly compared to that genomic action that we were talking about when we were thinking of transcription factors. Right, and then these enzymes right here control the activity or biochemical pathways of all kinds of pathways inside of a cell, and we're going to look at a couple of those. Okay, I think I talked about everything on this slide already. Same thing. But not everything on this slide. Okay, so remember, in terms of a control system, what kind of control system works the best? The tonic control system or antagonistic? Antagonistic, because there's inherent balance, right? There's balance and control. All right, so here we just see that this protein kinase is being activated by cyclic AMP, all right? And the balance to the system is produced by an enzyme that is pretty much always activated inside the cell, and that enzyme is phosphodiesterase. We saw this one in terms of the rod cells inside the cell, inside the retina. Okay, phosphodiesterase can convert cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP into its linear form. And when it changes to its linear form, it changes the conformation or shape of that AMP or GMP. And when it changes the shape, then it changes the activity so that it can't bind to this inhibitory subunit. So now this protein kinase becomes inactivated when the cyclic AMP is degraded by phosphodiesterase. All right, so you should know that adenylate cyclase and phosphodiesterase, how are they related to each other? What's the relationship between phosphodiesterase and adenylate cyclase? They are antagonistic to each other, right? And that's really a beautiful thing because you know of the autonomic nervous system, you know some examples in the musculoskeletal system, and here now there's one in this molecular enzymatic system for precise control and balance of activity inside of the cell. Okay, here is another second messenger system. The phospholipase C calcium system serves as a second messenger for some hormones. So here we have a hormone binding to a cell surface receptor. It's just the receptor, but it's coupled to a G protein. Right, so when a hormone binds to the receptor, these G proteins dissociate, they float around inside lipid world, and they bump into another enzyme that's inside the membrane, and this is phospholipase C. And this is a nice modern nomenclature because what's the substrate for phospholipase C? Okay, the C right here probably means that it's the third one of a phospholipase that somebody discovered, and so they wanted to make it a distinct name compared to phospholipase 1 or phospholipase 2 or phospholipase A or B or whatever. So here's probably the third one. But what's the substrate for this enzyme right here? And why is this pretty cool? Because in the name, we have phospholipid. Where are you going to go find a substrate for phospholipase C? I mean, if we want to change the metabolism of the cell, we need a phospholipid. Where on earth are we going to find a phospholipid? If you want a phospholipid, where are you going to go find it? A plasma membrane. Oh, gee. And where is this phospholipase at? It's right inside the plasma membrane. So it's surrounded by substrate. So the structure of the cell also acts as some of its important signaling compounds and metabolic intermediates. So phospholipase C becomes activated when it binds a dissociated G protein, and it produces something called inositol 3-phosphate, but we're just going to call this IPI-3. It builds up a compound called IPI-3 that can diffuse into the cytoplasm. IPI-3 can bind to endoplasmic reticulum, and in particular, smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And we said way back when, what are some of the functions of endoplasmic reticulum? It stores calcium, okay, which we see on this illustration right here. I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that because sometimes I forget and your book doesn't always mention it. Right? But it is a reservoir for calcium ions, but it's also important for manufacturing lipids, for instance. Rough ER is important for manufacturing proteins, but smooth ER is for the production of lipids. So here is sort of an interesting example of this modified lipid binding to smooth endoplasmic reticulum, because smooth ER is sort of associated with lipid metabolism in general. And this opens up calcium channels, and now calcium moves down this large concentration gradient from inside the smooth ER to the cytoplasm. And now this calcium ion, which is normally very close to zero in the cytoplasm, gets very, very high. And so this is really what we call a second messenger. But you could consider IPI-3 a second messenger as well. All right, so there's a little fuzziness in some of these designations. So IPI-3 could be a second messenger, but calcium for sure. Okay, because calcium then will activate some other kinds of things going on inside the cell. Okay. So IPI-3 can be a second messenger. Phospholipase C or a related enzyme can also produce something called diacyl glycerate. We just call that DAG. And DAG can build up inside the cell, changing the permeability of membranes to calcium. So calcium then concentration goes up very high inside the cytoplasm as well. So here are a couple other examples of things that could be considered second messengers. All right, so what does a cell do with calcium? Okay, well, it has a large electrical charge on it. All right, so what will it want to associate with? Some kind of negative charge, right? Because opposite charges attract each other. And we know that proteins have generally an overall negative charge to them. So calcium diffuses into the cytoplasm, and it binds to and it activates a compound called calmodulin. So calmodulin is a protein that modulates the activity of various other kinds of proteins inside the cell. But calmodulin can only be activated when it binds calcium. That's how it got its name. So the calcium calmodulin activator protein will bump into protein kinases and activate them, which phosphorylate other enzymes to produce the hormone's effect inside the cell. Because remember, when something gets phosphorylated, that phosphorus group is a big chemical moiety. When it gets jammed onto a protein, that's like your friend poking you in the side, that protein is going to change conformation, and that conformation change could activate an enzyme or deactivate an enzyme. All depends on how that system evolved. All right, so let's look at some specific examples. Here's a really good specific example. And we talked about adrenergic receptors once before. What's a ligand for an adrenergic receptor? How about acetylcholine? Is acetylcholine a good ligand for an adrenergic receptor? It is not. What kind of receptor binds acetylcholine? A cholinergic receptor. Like what? A nicotinic or muscarinic receptor are cholinergic receptors. What about an adrenergic receptor? Yeah, norepinephrine or epinephrine, right? Those are the catecholamines that bind to an adrenergic receptor. And you know a whole bunch about different kinds of adrenergic receptors. Like what are the two main subclasses? Beta and alpha, and then there's some subclasses of those two. There's alpha 1, right, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2. And don't forget any of that stuff, even though that was on the last, is that on the last test? No, it's on this one coming up. Oh, good. Well, don't forget it, because you'll need that information for the rest of your life, I'm sorry to say. Okay, so make sure you remember that, because even on this slide, look, we have beta adrenergic receptors and alpha adrenergic receptors. This dark area right here just represents a cell, and in particular a liver cell. And you know some special things about a liver cell. It's a really handy organ to have, because what can it do for you that no other cell in the body is willing to do? Yeah, it can break down glycogen into its building block, which is glucose, right? And then release that glucose into the bloodstream so that other cells can use that glucose as an energy source. Okay, so the liver stores a lot of glycogen, which we have right here, and you know what the building block is. And in order to get that glucose off, what's the name of this process right here? Going from glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate. Glycogenolysis, right? So glycogenolysis is controlled by these adrenergic receptors that are on the cell surface, on the plasma membrane. So let's look and see how this happens for these two different kinds of receptors. Well, the beta adrenergic receptors, we said, work through a second messenger of cyclic AMP, right? And so here, we see when a beta adrenergic receptor binds epinephrine, ATP is broken down into cyclic AMP, and you should know the name of that enzyme that does that. And that is, oh, it's on the slide. That's not so difficult. Okay. Okay. Adenylate cyclase is the name of the enzyme. But what is not on this slide is what kind of signal transduction scheme is this, that we have epinephrine on the outside of the cell and cyclic AMP building up on the inside? Yeah, it's a nice second messenger system. First messenger is epinephrine. Cyclic AMP is the second messenger. But what is this scheme right here typically? This is what, a G-protein coupled receptor, right? So the G-protein dissociates and activates adenylate cyclase, which then builds up cyclic AMP inside the cell. And when that happens, that activates a protein kinase, right? And we said, what does a kinase do? It phosphorylates something. And what it's phosphorylating is when it bumps into a glycogen, it will chop off a glucose molecule and bam, do what? Phosphorylate it right away. So that's a kinase enzyme. So now we have glucose 1-phosphate inside the cell, goes through a little isomerization step, it becomes glucose 6-phosphate, and then a liver cell has what? Glucose 6-phosphatase, which makes free glucose that can leave the cell and enter the blood. So that's as a result of the beta adrenergic receptor working through cyclic AMP. Okay, so when there is an increase in sympathetic tone inside the cell produced by what the flight or fight nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system, what happens to glucose levels in the blood? It increases, right? So under stressful situations, blood glucose increases. And what situations do we mostly operate under in our life? Everybody in here, I'm sure. Rest and repose or fight and flight? You know, probably not. I would say, since all of you are interested in becoming professionals, you don't have a very laid-back life. Okay? I would say you're operating mostly under stress reactions all the time, which promotes what? An increase in blood glucose. Okay? And that kind of mimics a condition that we call, what happens when you can't regulate blood glucose or when it's always very high? Yeah, diabetes mellitus. Okay? Just a stress reaction. Okay. But there are other receptors here. There are alpha receptors. So here we have an alpha adrenergic receptor. Okay, when it binds epinephrine, it's going to open calcium channels on the outside of the cell, or maybe open calcium channels on smooth endoplasmic reticulum, so cytosolic levels of calcium increase. That can bind to calmodulin. Calmodulin then can release the inhibition of a protein kinase by removing the inhibitory subunit. And then this protein kinase and this one up over here probably can work together to stimulate glycogenolysis, which then eventually ends up with what, adding all that glucose to the blood. Okay, so this is I'm sure is an exam figure too. Okay, because it kind of just illustrates the importance of G protein coupled mechanisms and calmodulin and how important calcium is. So what are the two second messengers that we see on this diagram in particular? Cyclic AMP and calcium. Okay, and it also kind of reinforces your idea that beta adrenergic receptors work through cyclic AMP as a second messenger and alpha adrenergic work through calcium as a second messenger inside the cell. And epinephrine is always going to be the, what is epinephrine always going to be? the first messenger trapped outside this cell. Okay. Here's another kind of receptor system, and this is an exam figure. Your book no longer has this figure. So you might want to just make sure that you have a nice printout of this figure. It's in your lecture notes. Right, this is a tyrosine kinase second messenger system. And in the name, it tells you what's happening here. You have an amino acid, tyrosine, that is going to be specifically what? Phosphorylated by this particular enzyme. So let's look and see what's happening here. This kind of receptor is used by insulin hormone and many other growth factors causing cellular effects inside the cell. It's a surface receptor because we know insulin can't get inside the cell. It's not lipophilic, it's a hydrophilic, it's a polypeptide. All right, so here we have an insulin molecule, and this is going to be similar to the scheme that we saw with dimerization when we needed homodimerization or heterodimerization to build a transcription factor. Here we have two subunits that actually have to come together as a result of this insulin molecule. All right, so when insulin is present, these two subunits join together to form an active dimer. And the activity is not extracellular, but the activity happens inside the cell. All right, so when dimerization takes place, then there is an ATPase on the intracellular side of this dimer that becomes activated. Right, an ATPase does what? It takes ATP and makes ADP out of it, right? And that extra phosphate then is added to the dimer. And when that happens, that activates other kinds of enzymatic activity on the inside of the cell. So it can phosphorylate other kinds of signaling molecules that are inside the cell using ATP as well. So the dimer has to be phosphorylated, and then some other compounds inside the cell have to be phosphorylated. And since these are enzymes, what can you tell me? An enzyme is what, used up during the reaction or not? It's not used up during the reaction. So as a result of one signaling molecule, that can produce, right, many, many hundreds or thousands of other signaling compounds inside the cell or active compounds inside the cell. And when it's a multi-step like this, we call that a cascade mechanism, right? And glucose uptake and other anabolic reactions are due to this kind of scheme, which we call a tyrosine kinase, because the residue here on this protein that moves across the membrane is a tyrosine amino acid in this location of the dimer. All right, so I would like for you to know this specifically for insulin hormones, because what can you tell me about insulin? Do you know anybody that has any problems or pathology related to this hormone? Yeah, oh, sure, a lot of people. It's epidemic, right? Okay, so we really have to pay attention to this, and it's a life-threatening process. So we want to know. So how does this affect glucose transport? Okay. Well, let's just say that we have high glucose in the blood and low glucose inside the cell. So we got a big concentration gradient of glucose high outside, low inside. Which way does glucose want to go? It wants to go inside the cell. But remember, glucose has a lot of oxygens bound to hydrogen. Those are polar covalent bonds, which means that it's a hydrophilic kind of compound. Glucose loves to dissolve in water, does not like to dissolve in lipid. So it has difficulty getting through the cell membrane as a result of that. So it needs some kind of transporter. And you're familiar with different kinds of transporters. We talked about all kinds of transporters already. Here is one. Okay, it's called a GLUT4 transporter, and when glucose bumps in, and it can be open to the outside of the cell, or it can be open to the inside of the cell, but not both at the same time, right? But when a glucose molecule bumps into it from the outside, since the outside is open up, then it's going to change conformation. Just the fact of it binding to this transporter causes it to change conformation, so now it's closed to the outside and open to the inside, and then glucose then can freely diffuse inside the cell because it's low concentration. So GLUT4 is what we call a facilitated transporter. It works by facilitated diffusion. Glucose still is going from high to low, but this is facilitated by the GLUT4 transporter. Without this transporter in the membrane, glucose cannot enter the cell. And if glucose can't enter the cell, where is it going to stay at a high concentration? In the blood. It's going to stay at a high concentration in the blood. Now what's going to happen to this cell? Glucose is a food. It's going to starve to death. right? So that's the essential problem with diabetes, right? These cells start to starve to death. The cells, especially that use glucose as a substrate, okay, or tissues that are highly metabolic that need a lot of energy to make ATP, because you know glucose is a nice entry molecule for glycolysis and the Krebs cycle, which then donates those high energy electrons to electron transport chain to make just gobs of ATP for us. So these cells start to die as a result, and organs that are specifically sensitive would be the retina and the kidney, the heart and brain, okay, all just start to die with somebody that has uncontrolled diabetes, right? So you really got to support people that have diabetes, whatever the form is. Okay, so how is this regulated by the tyrosine kinase receptor? Well, here is a tyrosine kinase receptor. When insulin binds to it, it produces signaling molecules which have become phosphorylated. Okay, and inside this cell, all of these GLUT4 transporters have been produced and inserted into vesicles. Right, so they're inserted into the membranes of vesicles that are inside the cell, and when they're in this vesicle, they can't transport glucose because they're deep inside the cell. These vesicles that contain GLUT4 transporters are called endosomes. So all these GLUT4 transporters inserted into endosomes act as a reservoir for transporting glucose inside the cell. So they're inside the cell. When insulin signal is present, right, as long as a person is still producing insulin and as long as they still have a functional insulin receptor system, then these vesicles, these endosomes, get translocated to the cell membrane. They fuse to the cell membrane, and now they're inserted into the cell membrane so they can function as facilitated diffusers, so glucose can enter the cell, okay, as a result of these phosphorylated signaling compounds building up inside the cell. So you might say, well, that looks like kind of a complicated system. It's kind of nice because in order to put these GLUT4 transporters into the membrane, remember, you have to go through transcription. You have to go through translation. You have to activate a bunch of nuclear elements. That takes a long time. But if you have these proteins already built and held in a reservoir inside the cell, then it can become activated relatively quickly. So this system works pretty quickly when glucose levels, for instance, increase and the pancreas then releases insulin and signals glucose uptake by cells. Okay, so it's really kind of a handy mechanism. The unfortunate thing is that it looks kind of complicated to you right at the moment. And there are a couple breakdowns in the system. There are a couple ways that the system won't work, and that is if the pancreas can no longer secrete insulin, then these transporters are not put into the cell membrane and somebody becomes a diabetic. Or there could be a circumstance where somebody has normal levels of insulin, but maybe the receptor is malfunctioning or is not being produced. That's another kind of diabetes mellitus, right? So this slide is pretty nice to look at because you see the two different forms of diabetes manifest right before your very eyes. Okay, there's something else that's pretty fascinating. I forget where I talk about it. Maybe I'll talk about it right now in this part of the class. There's something else that can put these GLUT4 transporters that are in reserve in an endosome into the cell membrane, specifically of muscle cells. Okay, even without an insulin signal. There is another way for a cell to insert these transporters into a muscle cell to decrease blood glucose and to increase the livelihood of these cells. And guess what that is? And it's probably the number one reason why people hate this class. It is exercise. Okay? So exercise can do the exact same thing as this insulin signal along with a competent tyrosine kinase receptor. So that's why people with diabetes are asked or told or informed that exercise will help reduce their blood glucose levels because these GLUT4 transporters are inserted into the cell membrane of muscle cells when they're active, right? So that is really, really handy. Really, really handy. So if I was diabetic, I'm sure I would exercise every day. I'm not so sure that's true, but it sure sounds good, okay? Okay, because if you exercise, guess what? If you need insulin, you need less insulin. And if you're uncontrolled diabetic, then that will help control your diabetes as a result. Okay, let's move on to an organ, a gland called the pituitary gland. You should sort of know where the pituitary gland is. Okay, so the thalamus is way up over here someplace, right? And then here we got third ventricle. Here's hypothalamus down below the thalamus. on either side of the third ventricle, and then right anterior to the pituitary is the optic chiasm. Maybe somebody can remember there's some mammillary bodies back over here. And then here is the infundibulum, which is the stalk of the pituitary, which carries signaling information from the hypothalamus down into the pituitary. And probably even from anatomy, you can remember that the pituitary has two major parts to it. There's an anterior pituitary and a posterior pituitary. And you might want to know that the anterior pituitary is called the adenohypophysis. The hypophysis is just another name for pituitary. Adeno means glandular tissue. All right, glandular tissue. So the anterior pituitary is a gland. It's an endocrine gland, and it secretes hormones into the blood. But this posterior part over here is not called the adenohypophysis. It's the neurohypophysis. It's actually nervous tissue. It's an extension of the brain. So the pituitary gland, or the hypophysis, has a lot of heterogeneity to it. It is part glandular tissue, part nervous tissue. Okay, and you should know which one is which. Okay, but nonetheless, both the anterior lobe and posterior lobe is controlled by the hypothalamus, but in two different ways. All right, the anterior produces its own hormones because it's glandular tissue. We know that because it says right here, adeno means glandular. Right, it produces hormones, and then it secretes it when it gets a signal from the hypothalamus. The posterior pituitary doesn't synthesize its own hormones. Right, the hormones are synthesized in the hypothalamus, and then they move down a tract. Can anybody remember what a tract is? A tract is myelinated axons that are going someplace in the central nervous system. So these hormones move through an axon by axoplasmic flow down to the axon terminus. And when an action potential, which is just electrical activity, reaches that axon terminus, then those hormones are released like a neurotransmitter would be released into the blood. All right, so since these hormones from the posterior pituitary get picked up by the blood, they kind of act like hormones, but because they're released by neurons, they sort of act like neurotransmitters. What would we like to call those things? Are they really a neurotransmitter or are they a hormone? It's pretty confusing. And the best way to think about them is that they are neurohormones, right? Because they're being released by a neuron, but they act like hormones because they get picked up by the blood. So that kind of reinforces your understanding that this is the neurohypophysis, the posterior is the neurohypophysis, but the anterior pituitary is the adenohypophysis, and during embryological development, they come from two different origins. Okay, this part comes from a part of the roof of the mouth, and this part comes from the brain. So, and it's just kind of miraculous that they come together. All right, so let's look at this posterior pituitary, or the neurohypophysis. All right, there are a couple of nuclei inside the hypothalamus. What the heck is a nucleus again? It could be the center of an atom. It could be a center of the cell that contains genetic information. But in terms of anatomy, a nucleus is inside the central nervous system. It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And that's what we have right here. We have the paraventricular nucleus and the supraoptic nucleus. Supraoptic is kind of easy to know. It just means what? Right on top of the optic chiasma. Paraventricular just means that they're on either side of the third ventricle in the third ventricle in the hypothalamus. All right, so that's where all these cell bodies exist. And their axons then course down through the infundibulum and then right into the posterior pituitary. So the supraoptic nucleus, these cell bodies and these up over here produce two hormones called ADH and oxytocin. They're translocated down to this axon terminus, put in synaptic vesicles, so when an action potential moves down these tracks, then those synaptic vesicles fuse to the presynaptic membrane, right, and are released into the extracellular space, and then they're picked up by this capillary in the posterior pituitary and carried everywhere in the body, right, and they will signal, they will change the physiology of cells in distant locations in the body if these cells have what? Receptors for either ADH or oxytocin. And remember, ADH stands for antidiuretic hormone that helps you conserve water, right? That produces very small amounts of urine that are highly concentrated in salt so that your body conserves water. Does anybody know what oxytocin does? We got to talk about it sometime. Might as well talk about it now. Right, it's a smooth muscle stimulant, exciter. So it's important for parturition because it causes the uterus to contract. It's also important for nursing because it causes smooth muscle of the glandular tissue of the breast to contract, and it produces the milk letdown reflex when an infant starts to nurse. Okay, so these two hormones come from the posterior pituitary. This tract is called the hypothalamo because it starts in the hypothalamus, right? So it's the origin and destination in the name, hypothalamo hypophyseal tract. And a tract is just what? A bunch of myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system. And then the infundibulum is really considered part of the central nervous system. And hypophysis, what's another name for hypophysis? Or hypophyseal means what? Pituitary-ish, right? Pituitary. Hypothesis is pituitary. All right, so that's how the posterior pituitary is controlled. The anterior pituitary, this is sort of a review from anatomy, not exactly, but a little bit of a review, because I think we had to talk about the tract versus the portal circulation. For the anterior pituitary, it's a little bit different. There are cell bodies of neurons in the hypothalamus that produce signaling compounds, but the axons don't travel all the way to the hypophysis. They stop right here in a part of the hypothalamus that we call the median eminence. It's the origin of the infundibulum. All right, but nonetheless, when these neurons become excited and send action potentials down to this axon terminus, it causes the release of signaling compounds from the neurons into the extracellular space, and they're picked up by a capillary. And why do you have to have a capillary right here? Because that's the only doorway for things to enter or leave the circulatory system, right? Because capillary walls are thin and they have holes in them. Material cannot enter or leave the circulatory system through an artery or a vein, only a capillary. So here are some capillaries. These are the primary capillaries that pick up those. Now, what the heck are these things? Are these hormones or are these neurotransmitters? These are neurohormones because they're being released by a neuron, but they're picked up by the blood, okay, in very minute quantities because this is a special delivery system, and it's a portal system. And you know that a portal system has two capillary beds back to back, but a normal circulatory system just has one from ventricle to atria in the heart, right? But here's the first capillary bed. Here's the second capillary bed in the anterior pituitary. So these neurohormones that are secreted by the hypothalamus go through this thing right here, which is called the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. Portal system means two capillary beds. And then these hormones or neurohormones diffuse out of the circulatory system through these capillaries into the extracellular space. And then they bind to receptors of the glandular tissue of the anterior pituitary, changing the physiology of these cells in the anterior pituitary. But since they're glandular tissue, when they become changed, they either are stimulated into releasing other hormones or inhibited from releasing hormones. So these neurohormones from the hypothalamus can be inhibitory hormones or excitatory hormones. Okay, one or the other. All right, so here is a really nice exam figure that lists the kinds of hormones that are released from the anterior pituitary. But we're going to go on to this, but we're not going to forget about the posterior pituitary. How many hormones are secreted by the posterior pituitary? There are two, right? And you should know their names, ADH and oxytocin, or the other way around. Doesn't matter. And you should probably know what their action is and what their target tissues are. Okay. The anterior pituitary has six trophic hormones, and a trophic hormone is one that causes the secretion from another gland, but it also stimulates the growth of a gland at some distant location to the anterior pituitary. So it maintains the health of a secondary gland someplace, but also causes secretion in these glands. All right, so trophic hormones that maintain the size of target tissues because they have, these target tissues have a receptor for the hormones from the anterior pituitary. First one is prolactin. And the only tissue that has, for this class anyway, receptors for prolactin is breast tissue, right? And prolactin will cause the maturation of glandular tissue of the breast, okay, during pregnancy and after pregnancy, as long as certain things are maintained, right? So it maintains the health of competent and functional breast tissue, right, for nursing. That's the effect of prolactin. And the target tissue is mammary gland. Okay, another hormone.